Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Now, five international leaders have been ousted. The not-so-super committee comes up empty. Oil over 100 briefly and then drops down. And we see the commitment of traders report cuts the most amount of commodities in the past several weeks. We have two guests coming up today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. James O'Shaughnessy, the author of the book What Works on Wall Street, and a very, very experienced investor. And I dare say, probably one of the leaders in quantitative analysis in the industry. And we also have somebody from the Occupy Wall Street movement, Garanja Gashusha. He's going to be here with us as well. All this and lots more on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 239 for November 21st, 2011. Well, hello, and how are you? Welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and we have, I think, a really, really great show because we have some great guests on, and I just really, really enjoy talking with the guests, and I get that that is your same opinion as well because a lot of the emails that I receive from you have always cited, hey, you know, you have some great guests. Thanks a lot. Bring on more. Well, we always learn something from our guests, whether we want to or not, and I think that that's the whole idea here of joining us each and every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And if you haven't done so already, if you're looking for something a little more basic, just a little bit of a touch more educational in terms of the understanding of the underlying themes, terms, and conditions of the markets, you could always check out The Winning Investor. That's a podcast I do as well, and it goes along with my second book, The Winning Investor. And you can check that out on iTunes, of course, along with DH Unplugged, which I do with John C. Dvorak every week. We talk about some really crazy things on that, all related to business, or at least somewhat related to business. But it gives a great aspect of what's going on. We talk with John, who's really a technology whiz, and then we bring in all sorts of the latest news and items that really are hitting the tape to talk about and to analyze, break apart, and to put back all together again. So I want to talk about some of the things that are, I guess, that are making news. We all know what's going on in Europe. There's no surprises there. I mean, right now, nothing is a surprise when it comes to Europe, I guess. But I think that the big issues right now are the inability for many of the leaders, particularly Germany and France, to come together on anything. They had a plan. They don't have a plan. They have another plan. Well, maybe not so. Now they're fighting about how to leverage or not the EFSF, the emergency fund that they put together with outside investors, as well as the countries within the European zone, and how best to really deploy that in a way that will be the most effective. Already, there has been a lot of discussion about the lack of commitment and political will and maybe even the seriousness of many of the leaders of Europe. But moreover, it's much more concerning that the news and analysis lately has come out that there's just not enough money to cover everything. Last week, we saw a few things that were really important. Remember the 7% number. But no other reason aside from the fact that that's the number that everybody else is watching. 7% or more on the bonds of Italy, let's say Portugal, Spain, that is a bad number. When the government has to pay over that, their budgets are blown. So already we're seeing that all sorts of trouble breaks out when Italy's bonds start moving higher. And you know how that happens, right? So what happens is that people are unwilling to buy a bond, so the price is simply dropping. Yields are increasing. And when that happens, and there's enough of that, well, you get all sorts of catastrophes happening. We saw that in Spain, there was a lack of interest. In fact, they couldn't get off all of their bond auction last week. And this situation is spreading very rapidly. And already, the disagreements are causing consternation amongst everybody around the world. Now, over the weekend, what we saw was that in Greece, the One of the parties that was supposed to be supporting the bailout and the measures that were taken recently to give them the $100 billion, remember that? Well, they're not signing anything. They said, you know what? If you don't take our word for it, too bad. We've done everything that we said we were going to do, and that should be good enough. Our word is good enough. And the guys that are giving the money are saying, no, we want you to sign on the dotted line that you understand all of the restrictions, requirements, mandatory austerity measures that you have to take, and then we'll be happy. Well, they're not going to do it. So who knows what that's going to lead to next week. Already inside of the cabinets of the new, government that's forming within Italy under Mario Monti, there is a dissension. There's problems. And, you know, what we're finding is that the bond vigilantes and the folks that are involved in any of the sovereign debt of those countries are pulling out very quickly. And the banks within the region are pulling out. So don't be surprised if you hear a lot of news next week on that. The other thing that we're watching very closely in terms of government issues is what I'm calling the Not-So-Super-Super Committee, who was charged with the responsibility a couple of months ago to carve about $1.2 trillion out of the budget and to create some savings so that we could pay down some of the debt. As a matter of fact, some of the ratings agencies have said that you have to do this or the threat of another downgrade will be coming. Now, as a side note, I don't understand how France, with what's going on there, isn't downgraded at this point, but the U.S. is. Nonetheless, they can't come up with an agreement. As a matter of fact, some reports say they haven't even met for weeks. President Obama hasn't done much, it seems, to get involved. And what's going to happen is, supposedly, that the requirement is that a $1.2 trillion will be automatically cut if they can't come to an agreement by Wednesday. Now, Tuesday's the day they have to actually get the plan in for review in order for it to get approved, if you will, for Wednesday. That doesn't look like it's going to happen, at least in any kind of concrete fashion. Now, who knows? At the last minute, they may come up with something. You know, clock strikes midnight, and they have something, and it's a miracle. Already, the various sides of the equation, the Republicans and Democrats, are teaming up and trying to figure out on their own, trying to figure out what they can do to maybe reduce the amount of money that is being discussed. Now, unfortunately, everybody knows that we actually have to have a lot more money cut out of the budget, a lot more of whether it's taxes increased to bring in revenue or some other plans that are no longer essential, cut, whatever it may be. So this is going to be a big issue coming into Wednesday as well, and a lot of economic indicators that are going to come out in the latter part of the week. We have some Fed speak, I think Tuesday or Wednesday. We also have coming up personal income and spending, which is going to be a big issue, plus some more manufacturing numbers that are coming out, which have been coming out kind of soft here. And here's the deal. So far, the U.S. domestic stock market here has been holding on pretty well. You may not think so, but if you look around the rest of the world, it's been doing really, really good. Really good. If all of a sudden our economics start to slip again, you know, we went through that little phase where they slipped and came back and they leveled off a little bit now and the question of recession was off the table. If, in fact, we see weakening economics once again, the stock market is not going to be happy. Already, one of our three market trend indicators, we use three of them, depending on the level of either trend up or trend down, one of them has triggered last week, and now we are in just still in an uptrend, but very close to the second triggering, which would be about a 0.5% drop of major markets from here, where they close Friday. Now, if that happens, we start changing how we invest. We don't just keep investing. We don't keep on throwing money at the long side. We'll go more to the short side. We will hedge out, and we will tighten stops. That's the things that you should be thinking about. Now, again, we're close. We're on the edge. There's a performance chase towards the end of the year. There's some question whether or not there'll be some quantitative easing. Companies have been giving mixed guidance. Lots of stuff going on there. But realize that when you look at the world situation with the surprise index, which we put up last week on the Disciplined Investor blog, and you look at the surprise index for Asia, it's been sloping down significantly. Factories have been slowing down here significantly. Leading indicators came in soft last week. That was a bit of a surprise. And again, the outlook from a consumer confidence standpoint is pretty bleak. Now, the high-end consumer keeps spending, but the average everyday consumer seems to be really just not going at it as strong as they were. And the question then becomes profitability. Something like this happened back in about 2007. We thought that, hey, you know what? We know about this housing crisis, but the markets are doing fine. Don't worry about it. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, one day, it seemed like everybody said, oh, my, you know, wow, oh, my, look, oh, ooh. You know what? The housing crisis is really an issue we need to be worried about. And when that happened, the markets really started to tank quickly. So stay on your toes right now to see how this thing plays out. The amount of talk and rhetoric, lies, and just plain old, you know, putting the carrot in front of your nose has been really what I think is leading a lot of things right now. But be aware that with all things that are going on, especially with the risk-on, risk-off trade, the dollar starting to move higher, the euro questionable at this point, currency transactions by governments really being dramatic of late, there's a lot of risk in these markets right now. Now, what we also saw last week was the Commitment of Traders report. This is the report that's put out that shows the hedge funds, the commercial traders, the retail traders, how much they're holding in terms of futures of soft foods and food stuffs, the metals, oils, copper, things like that. Well, hedge funds cut the most exposure on the long side that they have in weeks. I mean, really chopped it down. Again, we have a chart and a whole explanation of this, of all the different components on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You'll find that about Monday morning at about 10 o'clock. We'll have that up and running. But that's something you need to be aware of because they really can move markets dramatically. They also cut their exposure to the S&P 500 futures. And that's why you see the correlation of stocks and indices moving in tandem so well. Because futures are really leading the whole thing, and ETFs. So there's a lot going on there. And I think that these are things you need to pay attention to. Be sure to check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Because we have a lot of things on there that will help you through your investing process, whether it's stock-based information, economic reviews, just, you know, various information for you to check out. Now, I want to mention that, of course, before we get to our guests, which are coming up in a second, that this show is sponsored by GoToMeeting. You know that great group that is owned by a company called Citrix. You've heard of them as well. And this is a wonderful service where you can actually share your screen, work with meetings, work with other people, whether it's your kids, your parents, your office. You can actually have a meeting simultaneously without leaving your house. You can be in your skivvies if you want and have a meeting because you can actually share the information on your screen and you can have a collaborative effort with others through voice over IP. Very, very inexpensive. As a matter of fact, the first 30 days are free. You can do a trial of GoToMeeting. Simply go to GoToMeeting.com and put in the code podcast and you get a free 30 days of all-inclusive support and information and use that you could just check it out. Great, great thing to do. GoToMeeting.com. As I promised, we're here with James O'Shaughnessy. Jim O'Shaughnessy, he is a national bestseller writer. He has books called What Works on Wall Street. He is a well-known, very well-respected money manager, and I am so glad to have you on. This is your fourth edition, huh?
Yeah, the fourth edition. This one's a lot bigger than the third edition, so it's a lot more to get through.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's thick. But, you know, the thing about your work is it's not just all heavy reading because a lot of it is tables and information and exhibits, right?
Exactly. You know, what we've tried to do with this book is we've really done a lot more research. For example, this time around we're doing sector-level analysis and we've added lots of factors. We also have data now going back for certain factors to 1926. Mm. So there's a lot of additional stuff in here, but we tried to design the book so that people didn't have to read it all the way through. So for example, if you're a value guy, you can read the first four chapters sort of why things work the way they work, explaining kind of how we're programmed to fail as investors. That looks at both behavioral economics and neurofinance. And then you can go to the value chapters and you can say, okay, wow, I didn't think about this. Maybe that could be good for me. And if you're a growth person, well, you just go to the growth chapters.
Yeah. And what you have here is, for example, each one of them says, okay, well, what did this grouping of stock do, whether it's the high or low price to sales, high or low PE ratio, or whatever else the subject is. And then, you know, what's the Sharpe ratio? What's the risk? What's the dynamics per period? So it's kind of all really laid out very nicely. I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, you know, actually, I remember something. One of your first books that I read, it got me kind of hooked on some of this, and I went out and I emulated the data stream of information that you had. I think it back at the time was Standard & Poor's research, like data stream or data set,
Standard & Poor's CompuStat.
CompuStat.
Was the basic,
Yep.
Yeah.
I bought that. That was a lovely investment, actually. It was great. I don't know. Yep. I use Bloomberg now, but back then.
We still use CompuStat. We also have augmented it with, for historical research, the Chicago Research and Security Prices, or CRISP data set, which goes back to 1926. We also use MSCI, WorldScope, mm-hmm. and Bloomberg. So we've got them all.
So now, some people like Jeremy Siegel go back and they look at things like, you know, back to the 1800s. Is that really something that we can, you know, really, you know, hang our hats on?
Well, you can. We've got some data sets from well-known academics like Jeremy and some folks up at Yale, where you get really good price return to, say, 1870s. You know, prior to the 1870s, Roger Ibbotson has done a lot of work mm-hmm. that tries to recreate the security prices back to the founding of the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
It's very admirable, very admirable. But one of the things we have to remember is that, you know, in many instances, we're looking at five bank stocks, or we're looking at, you know, a handful of railroad stocks. So I think that for the purposes of trying to determine which investment strategies work the best, you really are kind of limited to 1926. And, you know, it also brings up a really good point that people should keep in mind when they're looking at the results, is that, you know, not all of the stocks that traded are included in these data sets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is there could have been a whole host of stocks that didn't do so well, that didn't get included in the data set.
Right.
So, you know, take all research that is historical research with a grain of salt. I think once you get past, like, 1950, the level of detail in the information is quite, quite good. And the database really does cover virtually every stock that was trading. Prior to that, it offers a really good indication, and it certainly should be studied because it gives you a really good sense for, you know, what could be the worst case scenario, for example. You know, one of the things we cover in the book is exactly that. What were the worst case scenarios for a strategy or a factor going back sometimes to 1926 and in general to 1963? Gives you a really good sense that, you know, markets don't go straight up. But also, you know, that markets, like we've experienced for the last 11 years, are kind of anomalous.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, what happens afterwards is pretty good things.
Well, one of the things, did you do any studies, for example? I know a lot of the things that you've done are something like, well, let's just talk about one that I've written about in my book, too. It's like the dogs of the Dow, as an example.
Yeah,
you know, what,
sure.
You know, you buy at the beginning of the year, you know, rotate it back at the beginning of next year, and then you kind of go along with that. Now, have you done any studies that talk about, like, for example, a rotation based on another factor, such as maybe some kind of sell stop or some kind of other indication of the market?
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot of those. Dogs of the Dow is one that I took back to the founding of the modern Dow Jones Industrial Average when it became a 30-stock index in 1928. We've done even further studies on a broader group with the CRISP data. And we've studied things like selling when there's a 50% loss, selling when it falls out of the top percentile or decile, rather, of by dividend yield or whatever factor you're looking at. So one of the things that we found sort of as a net result of that is some of the sell stops work very nicely, but you'd be surprised. You don't want close-in sell stops. We tested 10%, 20%, et cetera. You really don't add a lot of value until you really extend that to a 50% loss.
Wow.
And I think, I was very surprised. I was very surprised. And I think one of the reasons for that is there, in the day-to-day movement of even well-known stocks like those in the Dow, there's a lot of up and down. I mean, mm-hmm. just look at the market over the last couple of months. 3% and 5% days up and down are not unusual.
Yep.
And so when you move that down to the individual stock level, one of the things that you find is stocks bounce around a lot, and
mm-hmm.
investors need to understand that and sort of be able to stay the course. So one of the things that we found is that for most investors, for most individuals who are making their own choices and buying their own stocks, they're probably best suited to the annual rebalance of a portfolio. And, you know, just from a psychological point of view, and of course, this is really difficult because do-it-yourselfers tend to be really interested, right? So they check it every day and
yep.
they look at what they're holding. Probably bad for the performance of your portfolio. You're better off if you check less and or at least change less.
Right.
You can check as much as you like, but if you kind of have, and if you're a taxable investor, one of the things you can say is, you know, I really want to hold this and have a long-term gain, not a short-term gain.
Right.
Try to keep yourself honest that way. It's very hard psychologically, though. I mean, we have two chapters in the book that cover why it's so hard to be a successful investor. And, you know, one of them was written by my son, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, chapter 3 on neurofinance. Basically, what's happening, it's a brand new field, and what they're doing is doing these super fast scans of brains making decisions under uncertainty. And what they see when they look at the scan of the brain is that it's the emotional centers of the brain that are firing, mm-hmm. not the logical centers of the brain. So it's really like we are wired to fail because we get so emotional about what's going on in the short term that we make the wrong choice at the wrong time. And of course, that's borne out in the data. When you look at the Dalbar studies and you look at a variety of other stuff, looking at, you know, people's trading decisions. Terry O'Dean, who's an academic at the University of California, did a huge study, and what he concluded was the more people trade it, the worse they did.
You know, it's interesting because on one hand, I hear what you're saying. I get it, you know, and I understand the emotional part of it, but some of the components of the market valuation is on what people value a stock at, and that not one person, but the entire mass. So.
Right.
You know, I've always criticized, and I just had a conversation with somebody a little while ago about this whole discussion of, oh, stocks are cheap according to PE and all that. And I'm like, wait. There are a lot of other things that we need to put into it. That's just the easiest thing to convey, you know,
right.
to look at. And but PE, why is the PE of the stock market this on this date and that on that date? It doesn't only have to do with the earnings part of it. It has to do with people are willing to pay for it. And that's
no question.
And that's a function of, we don't want to say emotion, but it's a function of, you know, their own interpretation of the data that's out there and what they're going to pay, which is, again, personal preference en masse.
Yeah, there's no question about that. You know, PEs expand and contract based not just on people's expectations and what they're thinking about the future, but also on demographic data. I mean, when you look at the number of, say, middle-aged investors versus young investors, when there are a lot more young investors, PE tends to expand, right?
Right.
And so when there's a lot more middle-aged to older investors, PE tends to contract.
Right.
And the reason for that is pretty simple. You know, when you're 65, you start selling parts of your portfolio to live on. And when you're 25, you want to invest and make as much as you can. And so there's a lot to those numbers too, but you're absolutely correct. It isn't just, you know, you can't look at PE as frozen and say, if this, then that, because you could be in an environment where there are, demographically speaking, PE is going to contract rather than expand. And you could also be in a period where people are just unduly pessimistic.
Yep.
One of the things we found, though, is that one of the reasons why looking at valuations, not just PE, but things like price to sales, even at enterprise value, things like that, it does offer a good clue, because what we see is investing when people are really, really pessimistic mm-hmm. tends to yield the best results.
Right.
In other words, they don't stay pessimistic forever, right?
Right.
And particularly if in times like right now, in the introduction in the book, we look at the 50 worst rolling 10-year periods, again, back to 1870, using some of that data we got from a Yale professor. And what we found, we weren't so interested in, you know, how bad things were, and they were bad, you know, and just by way of example, the 10 years ending February 2009 were the second worst 10-year period since 1870. The first was May of 1920. So basically, we living through really bad time, 10-year period. But what we did then was we said, well, what happened 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years later? And what was fascinating was once you got to 3 years after these horrible 10-year results, 3, 5, and 10-year results for the next, you know, the ensuing 3, 5, and 10 years, no negative numbers. All of the returns were positive and quite strongly positive. And it gets you back to, of course that's the case, because what happens after one of the worst 10-year periods? You get people incredibly pessimistic
right.
about the prospects
right.
For the future, and things start getting really, really cheap, and dividend yields start going up, and, you know, wonder of wonders, the next 10 years tend to be good.
Yep. As a matter of fact, I think, if I recall correctly, I think it was you who coined the phrase sappy slugs, wasn't that you?
That's right. It was.
It was you.
Boy, that goes back.
Yeah, it goes back because I put that actual piece and an example of an alternative to the dogs of the Dow, which is that.
That's right.
In a way, in my books, I said, you know, this is a really good thing to look at because it's more than just the dogs of the Dow, which are the highest dividend paying. I have a question for you, and you could answer this because something's been bothering me for years, and that is the change in the makeup of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which used to be an industrial average, if you will,
right.
It used to be mostly, if not all, dividend paying stocks, and therefore you do a dogs of the Dow, and you have, let's say, 30 out of 30, and you get to pick and rank and all that on the yield. But now we have probably four companies that don't pay dividends or something like that.
That's right.
And does that, you know, they'll never be included in that. In the dogs of Dow.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really good point. And one of the things, one of the, I think, legitimate criticisms of the dogs of the Dow is, hey, your data set in 30 stocks is too small. You need to cast a wider net, like you said, the Sappy Slugs, which looked at the S&P 500. Or even if you've got access to a bigger database, you know, all big companies. One of the things we've also found, though, in terms of dogs of the Dow, one of the things that we did to see if we could get better returns was to look at actually what we call shareholder yield, which is the dividend yield plus any net buyback activity that the company is engaged in the prior year.
Mm-hmm.
So you get that by simply looking at shares outstanding. So if there's 100 shares outstanding a year ago and there's 90 shares outstanding now, that company has a buyback yield of 10%. Right.
Right.
And then if it's got a dividend of 3%, that would give it a shareholder yield of 13%. We found that actually worked better than just pure dividend yield when you're looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gets you over the stocks that don't pay dividends. Right.
Right.
A lot of those stocks, instead of paying dividends, you do huge buyback programs in the market. There's more than one way to get cash back to shareholders, and buying it back in the marketplace is one of those ways.
Yeah, I hear you.
So
yeah,
that works very nicely.
You know, just as another point, we also here, we subscribe to a couple different theories, but one of them, we do trade a lot in some of our accounts, but that's a different story. I mean, it you know, whatever floats whoever's boat it is.
Right.
But I do agree with you also that emotional trading, as a matter of fact, you have a chapter here, and it's entitled The Persistence of Irrationality and How Common Mistakes Create Tremendous Opportunities. This is page 37. There's a table here that talks about the chance of positive returns on an S&P 500 portfolio from 1980 to 2009. And it talks about, but then you also adjust it by an emotional adjusted average pain reward score. You know, how much pain and how much torment is someone willing to take on a position, and then what happens, and it drops it down dramatically.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's like my earlier point about the more you look at it and the more you revisit it, the more painful it becomes if things aren't going your way.
Right.
And conversely, the more aggressive and, in quotes, greedier you get when things are really going your way.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we found is that, you know, the persistence of irrationality is something that is baked into the system. So when people would often say to me, well, good Lord, why would you publish these results? Why would you let people know what works well and what doesn't work well? And my answer has always been the same, because people are always the main part of the equation, right? And they say, you know, people are what determined security prices back in the railroad boom of the late 1800s, right?
Right.
They are what determined prices when, you know, when RCA shot up 600% because it was a brand new technology.
Mm-hmm.
People haven't changed. We still react exactly the same way. In that same chapter that you're referring to, chapter 3, we look at the chart of the South Sea Trading Company that was a huge bubble company. It is not Isaac Newton's time. And then we show a chart of the NASDAQ in the tech boom.
Mm-hmm.
They're identical.
Yeah.
They look exactly the same.
Right.
So people basically haven't changed. We let, you know, I always say that the four horsemen of the investment apocalypse are fear, greed, hope, and ignorance. And if you think about it, only ignorance is not an emotion. Fear,
right.
Greed, and hope have wiped out more money than any bear market, because people's persist in their irrational behavior. And really, we kind of look at the way we invest, which is systematic quantitative investing, as arbitraging human nature.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you talk about ignorance. You can make a lot of money being ignorant. I seriously,
yeah.
I'm not kidding. You know, if you just, I sat, this is going back way many years. I sat behind these two, in front of these two guys that were talking about AOL the whole time at this hockey game. AOL. And I'm like, this is the early days on. I'm like, AOL, what is that? And, you know, we said, you know what? We'll take a look at it. We looked at it real quickly and, you know, It's interesting. Let's take a little piece of it. Well, I can only tell you, right? And then, for example, people will buy an Apple stock because they have an iPod, not knowing anything more about the company or not, but they like the product. Right. That's ignorance, if you will. I have a question for you. This may be a little more technical again, but you're the guy to ask this. Now, one of the things that really bothers me, it's one of those pet peeves, is the continual share buybacks that are goosing EPS on Wall Street. So you have a buyback that happens and everybody gets excited because the company's standing behind their stocks, creating a floor. But more importantly, that the company will now have less shares on the market and their EPS does not adjust on a ratio basis or a per. So is there anybody that ever tracks a repurchase adjusted EPS to keep everything nice and clean? Because it really is not clean.
No, I know it's not. And, we haven't seen any external data providers that do things that way. I think you could probably do it if you were adept at Bloomberg and Excel and adjust it for yourself. My guess is that it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. One of the things that we were able to test, back to 1926, is this concept of buying the decile with the highest buyback.
Mm-hmm.
And it does very, very well.
Right.
And again, it makes a lot of sense. We also test in the book for the first time all of the various accounting ratios. And one of the ones that really proved the best at telling you which stock to avoid was what we call external financing. In other words, how much of a company's operation is being financed through external sources like issuing stock or issuing debt. And, if you'd bought the decile of companies that had the highest use of external financing over the last 45 years, your return, your nominal return, not your real return inflation adjusted, but your nominal return was a loss of 0.06% per year.
Hmm.
Now, that's during, obviously, some of the biggest bull markets in history.
Right.
So the idea is pretty simple. Companies that are issuing a lot of shares or buying or issuing a lot of debt, generally toxic. Companies that are, on the other hand, standing behind their company and their shares and buying shares in, very, very historically,
and that makes
been
sense.
A very good approach.
That makes sense. I mean, one of them is cannibalizing their own capital and diluting the company on a regular basis, basically to pass through. It's almost like an annuity where they give you the interest and your principal back, right? And you drain it out over time. And then the other one is really just a pure stream of revenue generated by what they do. It's awesome. So, yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
I would recommend this. This is, just if you go and check this book out, there's just a wealth of information in here. Just again, as Jim said, you don't have to read the whole thing because there's things that may not be applicable. But, you look at a relative price to strength and where it's going to be and, the combining value factors with a single company. So I guess the question I have to ask you is, at the end of the day, which one is your favorite particular strategy? If you had to narrow it down and throw away all your other children, which one is the best, your favorite strategy that you say, at the end of the day, if I had to, that's the strategy I'm going to go with?
If I had to, I would go with it depends. Is it a conservative gym or is it an aggressive gym?
Yeah, both. I'll give you two choices.
Okay, so if it's conservative me, I'm going to go with the strategy that buys market-leading companies with the highest shareholder yield.
Mm.
Remarkable strategy, does very, very well in big, well-known, financially sound names, doesn't have the heart attack factor that you get from more aggressive strategies.
Is that ROE? Is that ROE you're talking about, or is that?
No. It's a chapter on finding the best value strategy.
Mm. Okay, gotcha.
And essentially, what it does is it uses the composited factors that we build in the book and discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So, looking for very financially strong companies, for example, companies that don't have very high external financing, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great conservative strategy. Now, for a great aggressive strategy, I would use the strategy that we develop in searching for the greatest growth stock strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a strategy that looks for companies that are reasonably priced in terms of their value factors, but that have great price momentum.
We call that GARP. GARP?
It's not quite GARP because GARP has more to do with what the PE alone is.
And it's
looking for a forecasted growth rate and earnings that's higher than the PE.
Right.
This is pure cheap stocks on the mend, so to speak.
Mm.
These are companies that are very, very cheap, and yet their price momentum has turned around. And over the last 3, 6, 12 months have done very, very well. great strategy, compounded at over 20% over the last 45 years.
Wow.
Very volatile, though.
Yeah.
I mean, let me stress that for everyone listening.
Right.
It is not a strategy for the faint of heart, and it tends to be a smaller cap strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to keep those things in mind, because as we were talking earlier, you know, people get emotional about things. They really want to keep, when they're reading that chapter, pay close attention to the worst case scenarios.
Right, and don't do it during the market hours, because it gives you you may get that urge to just do it. So
exactly.
Right? Do it after
market
hours.
Wait till the market's closed.
James O'Shaughnessy, author of What Works on Wall Street, the fourth edition, the classic guide to the best performing investment strategies of all time. A beautiful book, well done, lots of information. I want to thank you for joining me. It's awesome to finally get to talk to you.
Thanks a lot. Great to talk with you.
Now, we talked about over the last few weeks that, you know, this whole Occupy Wall Street thing has been really, in the news, and it's been going on over about 2 months. And I thought, man, I got to get somebody on the show that could talk to me a little bit about what exactly is going on, what what the ideas are and all that. So we have from the OccupyWallStreet.org, Garanja Gashusha, and he's been kind of on the streets involved in this. He's been involved down in New York City, right?
That's correct. Yes, I'm Karanja Gashisha from Occupy Wall Street, from the PR working group.
Mm-hmm. And so you were down there, and you've been down there since the beginning for the 2 months, or what? How long have you been involved?
I joined the Occupy Wall Street in early October, soon after I was laid off from I was actually an analyst on Wall Street from a European investment firm. And I've been there since, and I joined the PR working group because I felt that was where I could best put my services. On top of working on Wall Street, I also used to moonlight as a writer and mm-hmm. Journalist as freelance. So I felt that was the best use of my time there, especially given that I have the financial background and economics knowledge.
So the whole idea behind this, because this is what confused me a little bit, can you tell me what it is that Occupy Wall Street is really, there's a lot of different things about it. I'm going to talk about some stats in a second, but in a nutshell, what is the whole purpose and idea, the thrust behind the Occupy Wall Street, as you see it?
I find it always very interesting whenever I get the question about what the Occupy Wall Street is about, because really we have a very clear, concise message. It is about economic inequity. When people hear 99%, they understand that we are talking about the distribution of wealth. And Americans actually are very clear on that. So I always find it interesting that the media seems to have this limited capacity to understand that, because clearly the public is understanding it. There's over 60% support in New York City, for example, for Occupy Wall Street. And there's a reason for that, because people understand very clearly what Occupy Wall Street is talking about. It's a very clear and concise message. 99% of the people of people's interests, the interests of the 99% are not prioritized. It's the 1%. The interests of the 1% are prioritized. Of the 1% are prioritized over the interests of the 99%. And this needs.
So is everything supposed to be equal? Is that the point? Or is it supposed to be just a little bit better, diversified and dispersed? Or what is the whole point of, the inequity? I mean, I understand that some people that have not. Okay, I got that. There is some people that have a lot and some people that have nothing. I got that too. But what is it? Is it just the terrible disparity between the two polar opposites? Or is it something else in the center? Like, for example, you're out of a job. You may get a job one day. You're probably looking for a job, right? So, and you're doing some things in between. You know, what is it that the people that have that's such a problem?
In an ideal world, of course, everybody would be equal. We don't live in an ideal world. In the United States, however, the United States is number one in income inequality. It is the top most unequal country in income distribution. That is wrong. That should not be. In a close to $17 trillion dollar economy, the biggest economy in the world, the second one, China, is about $5 trillion, and can sustain 1.3 billion people. Surely, if China with its $5 trillion can sustain 1.5 billion people, then the United States can sustain 300 million with and distribute the income far more fairly. So, of course,
Hold on. Let's back up. You're telling me that you believe that China distributes the income fairly through the 1.3 billion people? Because have you been there? I've been there, and it's not fair.
No, you're completely twisting my words. I did not say that China.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You said that they could support
what
them.
What I'm saying is that it does support the its 1.5 billion people, however unequally. So I'm saying that with 16 trillion, that's a whole lot more, and we can do much better at distributing that that wealth. And this is not this is not socialism that I'm talking. I'm not talking about taking money out of people's bank accounts and giving it to other people. But what our government has been doing in the unfair taxation policies is actually redistributing wealth upwards from the bottom from the poor in this country upwards to the very wealthy in the treasury rates. Which is what really the Bush tax cuts amount to. During the Reagan years, for example, when even before that, taxation was in our best years in the United States, taxation was for the top 1% was 70% to 90%, and those were the golden years, after FDR. So the idea that this endless tax cuts, this endless raiding of the treasury is what the country needs in order to, for example, have jobs, is an idea that keeps being touted by the top 1%. And yet, even now, when they have the lowest tax rate ever that we've ever had, and the banks, for example, are sitting on $2 trillion in in profits, they're still not creating jobs. So the math does not add up. The top excuse me, the top 1% push, what they've been lobbying for, clearly isn't adding up. So the proof is in the pudding.
So, but let's look at something. There is some money coming around. I mean, I'm just saying, out of a job, the government is paying people that for 99 weeks. That again, it's not a lot of money. I'm not saying that's fair. But the government is paying people that are out of work, about a million and change people with 99 weeks of total unemployment benefits, right? So there is some money coming down. That has to come from somewhere. It comes from, obviously, working people, right? I mean, because they're paying their unemployment tax and all that. So you got
to be clear. To be clear, I've been working right up until the end of September this last September. So it's not. I've not been 99 weeks unemployed, first of all.
No. I'm not saying you. I'm just saying generally people.
I understand. Yeah. Just making it clear. Yep. I know you keep pointing out that I'm out of a job, so I just want to make it clear that I'm only a few weeks not working. I'm a fully productive member of this society, a fully productive citizen, as are many in the 99% movement. And the 99% movement is not about the unemployed. It's about employed Americans who cannot put food on their table. There are 56 million Americans, for example, who are food insecure, people who need help in order to put food on their table. These are not all unemployed people. There are Americans who work two, three jobs, who have more than both parents working two and three jobs, even, who cannot afford health care. Health care should not be a luxury, and especially when you're working. So the inequities in this country are not just about those who are not working. People who work in this country are food insecure, are living below the poverty line, are unable to afford health care. This should not be the case in the wealthiest economy in the world.
But I want to ask you something, because you keep on coming back to issues about the government and the people and the overall population, let's call it, and the inequities and all that. What is it about Wall Street that seems to be the focus here? Because I just don't get this. I think, if all the things that you're aggravated about and angry about, by the way, I'm not saying I'm not angry about that, and I'm not arguing with you. I think there's a lot of good points here, right? I don't understand why you're focusing on Wall Street. It should be focused on Washington. The government has been such an absolute destructive force by allowing so many of these things to go on and for allowing for excessive amounts of money to be spent just in such a, you know, in such a terrible manner. And, you know, I get the fact that you have to live in a capitalist society and banks, they do what they're going to do, and businesses, they do what they're going to do, and Wall Street and all that. But at the end of the day, the whole thing that has been gone on recently and the excess expense we're paying is because the government screwed up royally. Don't you see that?
We make it clear that we understand that we live in a broken system, a broken government system, a broken corporate system. Our contention is that we have a government that is bought and paid for by corporations. And as such, the government is just a pawn of Wall Street, of the corporate powers, of the moneyed interests. So we go right to the source. We are not really interested in the pawns, in their pawns in Washington. Let's be clear. Our government is corporations. We really do not have an independent government, and that is the problem. So that is the beginning of the problem. We have a situation where the fourth estate used media, but in fact it has turned into we have the fourth estate as Wall Street and the major corporations. They run this government with their lobbyists on K Street. We've taken it to them directly, to where they absolutely, to their origins, to where they live, right on Wall Street.
So, you know, I don't know what's happening. Your phone's going in and out a little bit there, but I don't understand. That's better. That sounds good now. But okay.
I'm sorry, I accidentally hit the what's it called?
Speaker button.
We heard you, but I
just was sounding a little strange there for a moment. Okay, so you're going to there because you believe that the government is bought and paid for by businesses and all that, and the government is not of the people, and it's really for the companies and et cetera. Now, obviously, the companies themselves, you believe that, I guess I have to say that from what you're saying, at least I hear, that you are not in favor of corporations having the power that they do, even though those are the employers that are out there. Do you make any distinction between what's gone on with companies here and with the hiring practice and the kind of culture that we live in now that wants cheap things fast, wants to have you know, luxury items at a lower price, and we have offshored a lot of the labor to other areas in the world? I'm not talking about you know, paper pushers. I'm talking about manufacturers. I'm talking about, you know, the essence of America. We've offshored so much because our culture wants things now, and we want them cheap, and we want them in quantity. And don't you find there's a lot of problem with that? And, you know, our expectations, it's more of a kind of what we've grown up with and how we've developed that we, you know, we can't wait and buy a car. We have to get it off the lot right away. You know, it's just that so many jobs are just gone because of technology. Do y'all see that?
Well, we're not here to protest against human nature. Human nature, of course, I understand. People want things as cheaply as they can get them. People used to get cheap goods, and the idea that we get cheaper goods because of outsourcing or because of shipping jobs overseas is really a fallacy, because what happens is that these companies, when they ship these jobs overseas, the average return on outsourcing, for example, a whole department, it takes about 10 years before they can actually see the return. So they're actually still, these corporations are still spending money for a good number of years before they can actually make the savings. And by the time that 10 years has passed, they're already out, you know, moving those factories, or, you know, things, the needs of the companies are shifting. So in fact, we are still paying the same price. This is a fallacy that we pay lower because companies ship their goods, ship jobs overseas. It is a fallacy. It is not accurate.
Wait, then why are we doing it? Just because we don't? Why would we do such a thing if it's not going to save money?
I'm not saying that corporations are sensible in their behavior. I mean, I observed this. I've been working on Wall Street myself. I saw, for example, my own firm shipping jobs to different outsourced areas, and it was made clear that we expect a return in 15 years. In that 15 years, those offices will probably be moved again, and it will be another 15 years. You know, there'll be another 15-year period that is expected. So, you know, sand does get moved from one end of the beach to the other in corporations. Corporations are not, you know, it's not. I'm not saying that they're that efficient either. There is a lot of waste in corporations as well. So, you know, you ask me why they do it. I can't really tell you why they do it. They have this perception that. That they are going to save money, but that's not what really ends up happening. They shift that money into other areas. They hire more people sometimes, but you know, or they shift from one department and shift into technology, so they continue to use.
Yeah, so that's a good thing, actually. That would be supposedly, I think that would be on the good side of the table for you, because if they're saving money and they're redeploying it to either hire people or to get more technology or to make things more efficient, at the end of the day, maybe there's more money for pensions, more money for healthcare, there's more money. Whether they spend it or not is, you know, that's a big issue. And right now, one of the problems is that spending has really been constrained because of the outlook being so cloudy. From 100 different reasons, we don't, you know, there's so many different things. Whether we go to look at the Japanese situation that happened, the slowdown in China, the European situation, who knows what's going on with Obama's tax bills or not, and Congress, and I mean, we can go down the list.
Well, first of all, I reject the premise of the question. The taxes are the lowest they've ever been. So the idea that corporations are squeezed by high taxes is a fallacy, again. The idea that there's insecurity and that is why spending has been curtailed is also a fallacy, because, in fact, what we are really in right now is a banking crisis. Wall Street is in a crisis. There's $600 plus trillion worth of derivative notes out there. There isn't anywhere close to not even 10% of assets available to cover this $600 trillion worth of derivatives, interest rate derivatives, and all the other types of over-the-counter derivatives out there. And that's one of the biggest issues with Wall Street, is that they have way overplayed their hand by selling products for which there are no assets to back these products. So we're in a banking crisis. The European crisis is a banking crisis. Countries have always had debt. So this is not a new thing. The idea that it's not that people have failed. People are still paying taxes. People are still paying their mortgages. But there is a banking crisis because the banks have overplayed their hand. They cannot back the assets that they have sold out there. And the reason that they keep selling over-the-counter derivatives for which there are no assets to back them is because they can continue to skim off the top in transaction fees, in commission, and pay themselves bonuses. Wall Street was bailed out in 2008 because it was on the brink of failure. 2009 and 2010 were record bonus years in spite of this. So clearly, Wall Street does not pay themselves because they are creating added value. They pay themselves because they can, because they have access to our money, because we entrust them with our pension plans, with our 401ks, with our brokerage accounts, and with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, they actually have access to our regular average bank deposits.
Well, let's not talk about Glass-Steagall. I'm totally against that as well. I'm totally against the repeal of Glass-Steagall as well. But I want to ask you something with this whole thing that you just mentioned.
I might just finish that thought, you know, I like to make it as clear as possible to the public that really what Wall Street is the equivalent of entrusting your chicken coop with a fox. And that's why they pay themselves the way they do.
Well, I'm going to add something that, and I think this is important, at least from what I see. The moral hazard that has been created on Wall Street has been birthed out of government's inability to allow anything to fail. And the CDS, you're talking about CDS, credit default swaps, the derivatives that you're talking about where they're, you know, selling the stuff with no backing and just the words, an insurance contract. The problem is that the reason why they're able to sell so much of this is because they do not believe there is anyone that will fail, whether it's a corporation or a government. And in fact, one of the biggest issues right now with the European crisis and why it was so important for Europe to do whatever they could to make sure that Greece wouldn't have a default that would be a trigger. So they did a 50% haircut. And why they had to go so far, the ECB and you know, Sarkozy and Merkel to go and find from S&P and from Moody's, is this going to be a default? Because if it was, they were going to trigger CDSs, and if they triggered CDSs sold by the banks, then therefore they would have to pay, and that was a big problem. So I agree with you. There's a big scam going on with the insurance and the protection and all that. So what do you propose?
I propose that over-the-counter derivatives should be traded on an exchange. That was one of the aims of Dodd-Frank. That has not actually been effected.
Well, that's because, let me interrupt, because Gary Gensler's an idiot. Gary Gensler's an idiot. He's in charge of the CTFC. He doesn't have CFTC. He doesn't have anything done a year and a half after he was supposed to. So I'm sorry, continue, because that guy needs to go.
Well, apparently we're in greater agreement than we thought.
Well, yes and no. No. I'm in agreement, but I have a problem with a couple of different things. I'll be honest with you. I think that that the general concept, and I am not in the media. I have a podcast. I would not consider myself. Well, I mean, I guess I'm in the media, but I'm your average Joe. I really am. Okay, and I'm, I guess, a part of Wall Street in some way. I'm a money manager, but here's the deal. I still didn't get your message, so I think if you're hearing a lot of people that don't get what your message is, maybe just as a point of reference, you may want to think about how to massage that a little bit and get that a little clearer. Number two, this whole, you know, it's getting a little bit sloppy. And, you know, I think that there is, you know, what happened a couple days ago in the park, and, you know, there was some violence and the reports of a murder and all this. I mean, that's getting some play. Now, you want to say it's the media's fault? Okay, but it still happened. But one thing I want to mention to you, I did pull up some demographics. I think this is very interesting. And I think that this is a little bit different than most people think. 64% of those who are in the Occupy Wall Street movement are...
I'm sorry, I cannot let you go on while claiming that there's been a report of a murder, because I have not heard those reports.
There was some kind of a death or something going on, wasn't there? Like last 2 weeks ago, I think, in... I want to say it's in California.
The only violence that I saw was the NYPD being employed by Bloomberg as a private force to protect his buddies, the field properties, amid a media blackout where they blocked out airspace in order to raid Americans expressing their First Amendment right to protest and to peacefully assemble. There was no violence exerted by members of Occupy Wall Street. The only violence came from police. The only violence that we've seen really has been from police. Remember the officer, I forget his name, Lavonia, I believe, who pepper sprayed an innocent woman. The use of barricades as weapons. The attempted use of horses as weapons, but thankfully horses are far more gentle than that, because they did not trample protesters in Portland, for example, where Portland, Oregon, where they tried to use those. There have been absolutely no reports of murder. So reports about alleged incidents are not
good. We'll use the word alleged. That's good, and I'll find out more about that. But my understanding is also that, yes, I agree with First Amendment rights and to protest peacefully and all that. Although, obviously, we know now that at least from this level, the First Amendment didn't cover supposedly the overnight sleeping in the parks, right? Isn't that what the judge came through with?
The judge did not say anything about the First Amendment. The judge said that Brookfield Properties have laws against setting up tents in the park. So that is a Brookfield issue. And the mayor employing NYPD as his own private force to hand out to his buddies is a violation. And by the way, Congress yesterday passed a $300 million cut in police programs. So I'm pretty sure that NYPD will be recognizing that they're part of the 1% too, and they're being affected by these austerity measures that are being pushed by a government that is bought and paid for by those very same interests that are employing them to protect them themselves. So I expect to see NYPD joining us in future very soon.
Actually, well, I'll tell you something. You know, I have a job. I have my own business. I live and breathe by what I do and what my, you know, people do. And but I do understand the frustration again against government. I'm having a difficult time with the Wall Street thing only because maybe I'm close to it. And I do understand the company and the corporation thing. I get some of that too. But again, I find our government to be to a point of almost detestable of how they've acted, operated in the past, in what they've done and what they've, their direction, their inability to to get things done. And frankly, a lot of the things that happened over the last number of years when it came to the housing crisis is very directly linked to the Clinton years when the CRA was established and the whole notion, which is just preposterous, that everyone deserves to own a home. Do you believe that?
Yes, I would love to talk about that, actually, because there is this notion that there's this lie that has been perpetuated, that the reason that the mortgage crisis came about is because people were not paying their mortgages. Yes, there was a foreclosure crisis. The economy actually could have swallowed the foreclosure crisis. The real reason that mortgage-backed securities tanked is because the mortgage-backed securities themselves were not backed by enough assets. So, in fact, the problem was mortgage-backed securities. To be very, very clear, the problem, again, was mortgage-backed securities in and of themselves, bundling mortgages and selling them over and over again where they are not backed by any assets. So it was the idea of securitizing mortgages bundled together, turning them into securities products, and then selling them to numerous customers as if this one security could somehow be divvied up to between a million different clients, for example, for all the same, let's say one, I'm going to give examples of numbers, but I don't think we have time for that now. But make it very clear that the issue really is mortgage-backed securities. Not
so you're telling me that mortgage-backed securities, securitizing the mortgages and all that, somehow magically screwed people into not being able to afford their homes and therefore foreclosing?
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is mortgage-backed securities are securities that are based on mortgages, but the amount of mortgage-backed securities that were being sold were far more in excess of what the underlying underlying assets actually were. So very much like the over-the-counter derivatives, mortgage-backed securities are pieces of paper based on very small amounts of assets. So they were multiplied. When you securitize mortgages, what happens is that the value is multiplied tenfold or however many thousands fold, and then sold as, give it up and sold as products as if they're backed by actual assets. Whereas, in fact, they're backed by very small amounts of assets. Very similar to credit default swaps and interest rate derivatives and other over-the-counter derivatives. So that's the real issue. Please be honest about that. You work on Wall Street.
Let's clarify a few things. I've been honest about everything, and I won't ever not be honest about something. So let's get that clear, and let's not make sure that we don't get into this whole thing that anybody that's not involved in your organization is not honest. Let's just get that straight, right? Do we agree with that?
I agree with that. I'm not sure that I claim that you're not honest, but I'm appealing to you to be clear about the fact.
I will
that
be clear. I'm going to give you my clarification. I always saw securitization in the wrong way. In other words, when securitization was done incorrectly, okay. In other words, leveraged up and things of that nature. I agree that that's a problem. But I will tell you that one of the things that happened was that people that should not have ever received such a large amount of a loan to buy a house compared to their income and their stability were given loans for a lot of different reasons. You want to blame it on the banks? Fine. You want to blame it on governments and their requirement under the CRA and equal lending programs to give that? That's fine. Second of all, the people got crazy about buying homes because values were going up. And what happened, therefore, was that the values went up and there was more value available. And people said, you know what, I could use a home equity loan, which was a lesson taught by the banks to take money out and use it as my ATM. Now, they did that. Now, should they have known better than that? Yes. Should they? Okay, but they didn't. And people just do what they do. We know that, you give somebody enough of something that is going to continue to do it. So that's what happened. The banks allowed them. Should the banks have not allowed them? Yes. Should the government do it? Yes. And then what happened was that when this little bubble popped for 100 different reasons, one, the leverage that was used by the banks, the 30 and 40 to 1 outlay mortgage money in the hopes that the underlying house would go up forever. Well, once that cracked and once housing prices stopped going up, obviously, that leverage worked against them dramatically. Totally agree with you. Second of all, people overdid it. So therefore, now all of a sudden they're out of jobs for, again, 100 different reasons, okay? They're out of a job. They no longer could afford it. Or, more importantly, their adjustable rate mortgage that they never expected would go anywhere above where there was at 2%, let's say, all of a sudden adjust to an 8%, and now they can't refinance because the house isn't worth that much, or they don't have a job. So the whole thing came together like this whole crap fest. And I think there was a lot of blame to be put on Wall Street because they're greedy about selling the deals and all that. Investors who bought it because they needed income, that includes grandma and grandpa, by the way, and the government for not having the appropriate amount of oversight on this. And finally, I think that the average person who just really tried to push it to the max by taking everything they could out of it and buying every toaster and every car and every gift for Christmas that they could. Anything wrong with that?
What I'm hearing here is you making a very direct indictment on the banks for over leveraging A, the mortgage backed securities, B, for over leveraging on home equity that didn't, you know, that was really a house of cards that didn't exist, but we are talking about two different issues here. The foreclosure crisis is a crisis of consumers, of the American people. And I personally believe, as a person who works on Wall Street, with my financial understanding, I personally believe that the foreclosure crisis in itself is a very separate issue, and it is an issue that could have been absorbed by the banks. However, the idea of the crash that was caused by mortgage-backed securities is a very separate issue, and this is directly can be indicted directly onto the bank. So, and the foreclosure crisis has continued in spite of this. We are in a slow recovery. I think that is how it's referred to. So, even in this slow recovery, the foreclosure crisis continues. Apparently, the economy is absorbing it. So it is not causing a crisis of the banks in itself. The crisis of the banks is a crisis that is caused directly by the banks. It is caused by over-leveraging in all manner of different securities. We described two, mortgage-backed securities and over-the-counter derivatives as examples. And these are the ones that I'm most familiar with because they're the ones that I've worked in my experience on Wall Street. But I'm pretty sure that there's many other securities that are over leveraged. The banking crisis is really the reason for this economy, and that's why this recession is different than the average, the regular up and down recession that cycles that we have seen over the last 70 years or so. However, the banking crisis that we are in right now is very similar to the 1929 crash and the crisis that followed, because both of these are crises of the banks very directly. And clearly, as in 1929 and as we are seeing now, when the banks over-leverage, the result is catastrophic economic downturns that lead to devastating depression, or in this case, in the first case was the depression, the Great Depression, and in this case, the Great Recession. So let's be very clear. My indictment here is on the banks, and the reason that it is on the banks, and the reason that the banks are allowed to do what they do is because the banks spend all this money lobbying Congress and both sides of the political divide to favor them, to pass laws in retrospect, as the repeal of Glass-Steagall was done. Mm-hmm. It was done after the merger of Citigroup and Citibank, Travelers and Salmon Smith Barney. It should never have been pushed through, but in fact, it was pushed through at the behest of Alan Greenspan. And talking of Greenspan, by the way, Greenspan made it very clear recently that he does not favor endless tax cuts, and he made it very clear that the only reason that he was in favor of the Bush tax cuts was because at the time there was
we were in a growth position. We had a surplus.
Right, precisely. So he made it clear that he favored tax cuts during a surplus, because he saw no point in keeping money in the bank, in the coffers of the Treasury, because once it is given to people and to companies and it is spent, it multiplies. But he made it very clear that once you start going into deficit, tax cuts should be stopped. So even Greenspan, who as many people consider conservative, is of the view that the endless tax cuts are bad for the economy.
Yeah, I understand. We got to cut this a little bit shorter. I want to mention something real quick. 64% of the occupying Wall Street movement, we got off the web, so you can tell me if this is right or wrong, give or take. 64% of those occupying Wall Street movement are under the age of 35, according to a survey, about 1,700 people. 20% of the over the age of 45, according to the same survey. More than 26% are enrolled in school, more than 75. 13% of the survey takers said they earned more than 75,000. 2% said they earned more than 150. Let's see. 15% of the demonstrators who are unemployed, according to the different view. This is the, what does that say? I don't know what that's saying there. I don't know what that means. Nope, this is nothing about there, too. So it's a pretty, here it goes. I'm just kind of going through all these numbers here. 32% they're considered Democrats. 56% say they voted in 2008. Okay, great. At least 25% they will not vote in 2012. 51% of the demonstrators now say they disapprove of Obama. This is, again, a survey done by, who was it? Baruch College professor, I believe. Here's the question for you, I guess, in the thing. If you were to, I still think that government is a big part of this whole thing, and that really needs to be addressed, and don't let the Democrats or the Republicans catch on to anything that you're doing and try to claim it as their own, and they're the good guys in this, because they're really the bad guys as well. And I think that's a message that you need to send across. That's my opinion. But at the same time,
we're in agreement on that one. We aim not to be co-opted by either party. We have one party, the Democrats, that have been paying lip service to some of the progressive ideas that we've been pushing, and we have the Republicans, who have made it very clear that they're the party of cooperation. So, lip service or making it clear one way or another, the result has been the same. They have all been married to cooperation.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all are, because I think that's part of the way that our country works at this point. But I understand that you want to change that. Again, I have some general feelings for this. I think that I understand the frustration. I understand what you're talking about. I still think that many of the core components of this, I don't know how they're going to change. I think that if corporations are as strong as you say they are, and if they're in the pockets of the politicians, then really, none of us could do anything. And not to be, throwing in the towel, but I'm saying, that if that's the statement. On the other hand, a lot of good grassroots things have started. I just tell you that I just hope that the direction is clear and the people that are involved, and I'm just, I don't know this, are understanding that this isn't just all about, hey, I don't have a job, I'm pissed off, let's move on. I mean, this is a bigger picture, and that, this isn't just a reason to party at the park, right?
This is absolutely not about that. This is truly a 99% movement, and it is not the statistics that you quoted me about people who were at the park are not reflective of the membership of the 99% movement. The 99% movement really is a movement that is looking to attract the American public, as they are, because everybody is affected by the economic situation we're in, and everybody is affected by the system the institutional systems that we are in, whereby we have corporations buying and paying our government.
Wait, you don't think my survey is correct?
I'm not saying your survey is not correct.
Before you answer, I'm going to tell you the survey came from OccupyWallStreet.org.
I'm telling you that the survey is a survey of the people actually within Zuccotti Park at given time. Mm. So it is not, it does not reflect the full movement. It's a reflection of it's a reflection of a point in time.
A snapshot.
It's a snapshot. Absolutely.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to put some of this stuff on the web, and I'd love to hear from my listeners what they think about this. And again, I think that the essence of this is obviously naturally, the old, I guess we can boil it down to, I don't want to be screwed, and neither should you be. And at the end of the day, we're all dealing with this not only here, but around the world, all the stuff that's going on. You think it's bad over here, try to see what's going on over in Greece and Italy at these days. But at the end of the day, I think that I hope that, you know, yeah, you can change some of this into the way that it is a little bit more appropriately, I don't know if fair is the right word, but let's put it this way, that gives everybody a fair shot. That's what I would say. That's my opinion.
I think we are in agreement on that, and I'm glad to see that we're in greater agreement than you might have suggested at the beginning of our interview, actually.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Listen, we'll talk soon. We'll have this up available for you to post any comments that you have, of course, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Garanja Gashusha, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too.
Well, that was full of information, and I think a different perspective. And I really wanted to hear what they had to say from the Occupy Wall Street movement, and hopefully you got out of that something. I think that it's very interesting, the overall expectation of what can be done and what can't be, and maybe this is something that will morph into something that actually becomes a powerful effort to change, I hope, government in a way that will allow for the old serving the people to come back, rather than putting the politician in a position that they have power, where they can manipulate and just stretch the system for their benefit. Because right now, that's how I look at things. And, you know, unfortunately, I hope that changes soon. I hope that I'm wrong. But I'm very soured on the whole system over the last number of years. And it really needs something to change it. It needs a catalyst of some sort. So maybe this will be it. Maybe it won't. But if you have any questions for them, obviously, we'll have all the information on our website on Occupy Wall Street. I will tell you that we have some posts up on Occupy Wall Street, and they're getting a tremendous amount of readership. And there's a lot of interest in this area. A lot of people are for it. A lot of people are against it. I am still kind of stuck in the middle here of really what do I think about it. I have some opinions for and against. Okay, so that's how it is. But again, I just wanted to give you what I thought would be a kind of a clear view from their perspective. And then you can make your decision. I want to thank you for joining me, of course. If you have any questions at all, send them to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And next week, we will provide you those jokes that were sent in. And if you haven't done so, for Das's book, send me a joke of some sort. This is a little bit crazy, but send me a joke that relates to Europe somehow, and you have a chance of winning a hardcover book done by Das, Extreme Money. Until next week, I thank you. Have a safe week. Make sure to visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com and be profitable. What else can we ask for? Have a good week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.